You've probably heard of Neuromancer, or maybe Neuralink, or at the very least, neural networks. But have you heard of neural GCM? Machine learning dominates the conversation, but what will happen to the centuries-old physical equations that built our understanding of the atmosphere? How are the two approaches at odds? How might they coexist?
Today's paper, Neural GCM, sheds light on how physics-based and AI approaches might be a powerful pairing for weather forecasting. For the first truly hybrid model we've discussed, it's only fitting that we've also taken a hybrid approach in this conversation. So join us for hybrid models, data compression, Dragon Ball Z, and the strange future of primitive equations. If you'd like to skip directly to the part of the conversation where we talk about the paper, we get into it at about 18 minutes and 30 seconds.
Yeah, you could use the chapters if they show up. And I would definitely recommend that if you like Marta, Alden, and I, but you don't want to hear us blab on and on and on about books.
Yeah, or if you just hate books and you hate people who read.
Yeah, if you hear the sound of paper pages flapping in the wind and you're like revolted, definitely skip ahead to about 18 minutes and 30 seconds. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, everyone, back to Weathering, or welcome to Weathering if you've never joined us before. We are going to cover neural general circulation models for weather and climate today.
Yeah, I think the street name for this paper is Neural GCM. Yeah, all these papers have a street name and a paper name. But yeah, it's cool to see some of the authors in this. Actually, there's one of the co-authors is on the dynamical.org steering committee.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Have we risen to the level where we have to do disclaimers like that?
Yeah, we're extremely biased and we're going to give a really good take on this paper, non-critical take on this paper because of it. Yeah, I'm excited about this one. I think we exist in the universe of people who think about AI for forecasting things and like have gotten over the hump of disbelief that AI is a great fit for that problem. And even in some comments on some of our previous episodes, I've seen some folks that appear to be like traditional meteorologists being like, what about a hybrid model? I get that AI is powerful, but I can't just throw my conceptual understanding, these differential equations, I can't just like toss them into the ether, right? And I think this paper does a really cool job doing the hybrid approach, and I'm excited to talk about that. Because I think it's related to, it has an element of the end-to-end stuff. It's like a different kind of end-to-end. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself because we got to do our in the lit weather reports.
Yeah, we have to bring the context before we go into the text.
That's right.
That's the approach.
That's right.
Yeah. Are you introducing yourself?
After our first episode, someone, as I mentioned on episode two, someone was like, y'all didn't say who you are. And that was by design. And then Alden and Marta kindly introduced themselves, and then I continued to skirt the question. And so here in the third episode, I will yet again skirt the question, but answer it in the way that I wish people's LinkedIn profiles gave insight into who they are versus just a resume. Which it's not, and it's not even like the good parts of a resume. A lot of times when I look at a resume, I look at the activities. I'm like, oh, cool, rock climbing. And no, for HR listening, I do not bias hiring towards rock climbers, even though we have a ridiculous number of rock climbers on the team. But here are my interests/activities as a way to understand who I am. On Friday, I went to a great concert, Yola Tango and Built to Spill. It was fantastic. My favorite author is Ursula K. Le Guin, who I saw. She signed something UK Legie, which I think is just absolutely, it's so badass. let's be real. You know who that is. But if you don't, she's, I think, the greatest sci-fi writer. Got me hooked on science fiction at a young age. And I think that really helps like open your brain and think about what's the, you know, what's beyond. And I think that's really important for science. What else? I run and rock climb, and I think maybe pseudo professionally, I'm really into almost like off-grid software. I've heard people refer to it as the small web, home cook software. And I actually, that's something that has attracted me to a lot of these papers that are about like parsimonious and the computational efficiencies of weather models, like lets you be a little bit more self-reliant. And it doesn't really cross into that small web stuff yet, but we're doing some cool stuff with Dynamical that I think will bring some of those themes up. That's coming soon, a little teaser. But yeah, that's me in a nutshell. And if you missed the last episode, I work with Alden and Marta and studied computer science long ago.
Yeah. Arshil is one of the few people I know that is could accurately be described as a technologist Luddite. Simultaneously a very effective user of technology, but particularly the types of technology that are simple, efficient, and that's something I like about you.
Thanks, Alden. Yeah, I hate Kubernetes, for example.
That's a software engineering joke.
If you know, you know. Okay, so the same person who asked who I was recommended this book, Chaos, by James Gleick, Making a New Science. It's literally about Lorenz, butterfly effect, chaos. And I really wish I had read it before we made that episode where I confidently claimed that all things were forecastable, predictable, modelable. I still sort of hold that belief. I'm not done with the book. So I was telling Alden and Marta, there might be some kicker that makes me repent, but it's great. It's almost like some of my previous recommendations, the Benjamin Labatou, except a little less crazy, like weird out there. I normally don't like nonfiction, but this is doing the trick because it's so topical for what we're talking about on the show. So I would really recommend it. And then my weather report in Nashville, Tennessee, it's been hot, and that hot humid means hard to predict thunderstorms. And it's basically constantly rumbles of thunder in the distance, which is pretty sick and soothing because that's just like the background noise I grew up to. But all the weather forecasts are completely wrong about when it's going to rain 100% of the time. I have actually, I know this is wild to say on this podcast, given what we talk about, but I have stopped looking at the weather forecast and I just look up. I look up at the sky now. And I was disc golfing with my friend this past weekend and we were getting rained on. We did the literal like finger lick, hold it up to the wind, judge the direction thing, saw the clouds, said, all right, we think it's going to stop raining in about 30 seconds. It did. So that's now happened multiple times where I just like, you know, use my eyes and my wet finger to predict the weather.
It's very in line with your hot take from our first episode that you can predict anything. And what you meant was you personally, Marshall, can predict anything.
Yeah, you could predict anything. And also the weather forecast is so bad that I've given up and just look up at the sky. Somehow those coexist in my heart.
Two things can be true at once.
Yeah. What about you, Marta?
I have been thinking a lot about wind, and I would say this is also kind of connected to the summer thunderstorms that I think we in the Southeast get so much of, and Mid-Atlantic too, where I am. I forget sometimes they don't live in the Southeast anymore. But yeah, I love those moments right before a thunderstorm when there's so much chaos in the air and the wind starts to rise. And it's been so hot. We've had like the heat index in Maryland has been like 115 degrees, just completely uncomfortable. And the only relief is wind or water. And so I keep on also planning these like crazy kayaking trips on the hottest day ever, getting hellacious sunburns. And there's no way to tap out, you know, like you're hoping for the wind to come. So I've been thinking a lot about wind, and I really was digging into this yogic concept of wind recently. For folks listening, I don't think I've said before that I practice a lot of yoga and I teach yoga. And so in yoga, there's this concept of the vayus, which essentially means wind, and it's kind of like your bodily wind channels. And there are two fundamental energies of life-giving wind and destructive wind. And then those energies follow the five cardinal directions. In yoga, there's five cardinal directions, the fifth one being center. And so just thinking about those energies and those directions, I think I'm always reminded that yoga gives us such a like bodily vocabulary for experiencing the outside world. Mm. And on that note of...
Well, wait, before we move past that. Yes. We're currently, we got our heads in the sand, only using the U and V index of wind in our forecast. We got to be using all five.
Yeah. Well, the five subdirections of the two primal wind energies. Yeah. So there's technically 10 yogic winds. Yeah.
At different elevation levels, probably, even.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to give a class on Ayurveda here, but maybe one day.
Maybe the weather modelers, we could learn a little something from this.
Well, I will say the yoga students are being subjected to the weather forecast, because I did give a Dharma talk recently about the vayus and made them all. Everyone who comes to my class like for a workout, they never come back, because we're talking wind. So, yeah.
This is actually Marta's second podcast.
Pretty much. But I love the way that yoga expands my brain and my understanding of the outside world, and my book recommendation does the exact same thing. It is a work of nonfiction. So, Marshall, I didn't realize you hate nonfiction.
I don't hate it. I struggle. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I don't want to interrupt your flow here, but I need to respond to that.
No, I get it. Yeah.
I just like in any moment, I'm reading like five nonfiction books in parallel because they're so boring. No matter how good they are, and like I'll get through them eventually, but I need to always pair them with fiction, especially for the book I'm reading now, or like Gerda Lescher Bach, or even some of the ones you've recommended, Marta, that I have on the shelf behind me. I don't want to read them before bed, do you know? Because I want to be like active mind, sometimes even taking notes, whereas like a novel that is like about a different world is exactly what I want to read before bed, so I could stop thinking about everything else.
Well, yeah. That's so funny, because I read before bed to help me go to sleep. So the nonfiction is perfect for that. But you got to dive into creative nonfiction. Yeah, that's creative nonfiction, The Forest Unseen.
I'm holding up The Forest Unseen, which was Marta's last rec. I wasn't kidding when I was saying that when she recommends a book, I'm just in the background buying it.
Well, pull up thrift books right now, listeners. I would love to share with you all Landmarks by Robert McFarlane. It's a beautiful book. And the epigraph is from the poet Norman McKeag. Scholars, I plead with you, where are your dictionaries of the wind? And that's effectively what this book aims to do, is create a dictionary or glossaries for these words that are disappearing along with the features of the landscape and our natural world that are disappearing, both because of anthropogenic climate change or just a distanced relationship with the land. So this book is full of actual glossaries of words, most of them from the UK, where there's been so much environmental degradation, and that's where Robert McFarlane is from. But it's also great essays about this concept of how creating that vocabulary then creates a deeper sense of knowing, which then creates the ability to love and to defend the natural world. So as I learn more ways to think about wind and more wind words, I think these sort of concepts of what that naming and knowing then really yields for you in your relationship with nature.
That's awesome. That reminds me, there's this like 1913 edition. I think it was like a Webster's 1913 edition. I'll have to find it and share it with y'all. Every word is the most poetic description of the word you have ever read. Sometimes sidestepping the objective of actually defining it and just creating something beautiful. Whenever I'm like thinking of naming something, I look at how that old dictionary describes natural phenomena. So I think I would love that book recommendation, but I'll also share the 1913 dictionary that I used to use.
Alden, do you have a book recommendation?
I do.
Cool.
Although maybe I'll start with the weather report. This weekend, kind of like Marshall, got to watch some cool thunder, except in this case, it was pretty far away. And it was in clouds and just got to watch lightning happen in clouds, being totally not in the storm at all. Like I was in clear, totally fine weather. And I think I've seen that happen a couple times before. But what really made this one very cool was while this was all happening, the moon then proceeds to just rise from behind the cloud that the lightning is going on in. It was a very cool combination of natural phenomena all in one place. And that kind of ties into my book recommendation. It is Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine.
Oh, classic.
Nice.
I had to talk about it right now because it is a particular tradition of my wife and her family to read this book at this time of year because it is such an incredible description of the type of weather that happens in the center north of the United States. It's based in Illinois, and it's basically this chronicle of this young boy's childhood in a small town in the middle of the 20th century Illinois. And the descriptions of weather are incredible, and weather plays like such a huge role. And I think it became a tradition to read it at this time of year because it is so like of this time of year. If you're living up, you know, in the northeastern United States or the central United States, and it's very, very fun to read at this time. So
such a good book. I could definitely co-sign that recommendation.
I am nostalgic for a northeastern childhood summer that I never even had because of, like, I grew up in the western U.S. because of the way he's able to write it.
Yeah, I feel like that's such a testament to the power of language and preserving these experiences of weather and landscape. And it reminds me of, there's another section from McFarlane. This first essay in this book is about the finding that precision of language so that you can create embodied experiences for people reading them. And without those, he says that we drift off into abstract space. And so I think of these books that we recommend are totally soul companions for the kind of work that we are reading about in the papers, I would say.
That's great. Okay. Shall we get into the paper?
Let's do it.
I'd love to introduce it by reading some of the abstract. Is that cool with y'all?
Yeah.
All right. So again, we're talking about Neural GCM as part of the Neural General Circulation Models for Weather and Climate paper published in Nature. It came out a lot earlier, but then the Nature article came out in 24. So the abstract goes, General Circulation Models, GCMs, are the foundation of weather and climate prediction. GCMs are the physics-based simulators that combine a numerical solver for large-scale dynamics with tuned representations for small-scale processes, such as cloud formation. Recently, machine learning models trained on reanalysis data have achieved comparable or better skill than GCMs for deterministic weather forecasting. However, these models have not demonstrated improved ensemble forecasts or shown sufficient stability for long-term weather and climate simulations. Here, we present a GCM that combines a differentiable solver for atmospheric dynamics with machine learning components and show that it can generate forecasts of deterministic weather ensemble weather, and climate on par with the best machine learning models and physics-based methods. Neural GCM is competitive with blah, blah, blah. They then start talking about some of the accuracy stuff. And jumping to the end, because I think this part is interesting. For both weather and climate, our approach offers orders of magnitude computational savings over conventional GCMs. That's a theme we see a lot in all of these machine learning AI papers. Although our model does not extrapolate to substantially different future climates. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Our results show that end-to-end deep learning is compatible with tasks performed by conventional GCMs and can enhance the large-scale physical simulations that are essential for understanding and predicting the Earth system. So there's a lot in that abstract to unpack, but this is the first time that we're tackling a what you can call, at a high level, a hybrid model, using the physics equations and sprinkling in some machine learning to make it better. And they do it in a pretty elegant way that I'm excited to talk about. Where do y'all want to start?
Well, should we talk about what that approach is that makes it a hybrid model? Because I love this phrase, dynamical core, and I want us to talk about what that means.
Yeah, let's do it. This combines a numerical solver for large-scale dynamics with tuned representations for small-scale processes, such as cloud formation. So that's both how this model works and how traditional weather forecasting models have worked for numerical weather forecasting models that many of us rely on day to day have worked for many years. So they've got this combination inside of them of what's called the dynamical core that has these sets of equations called the primitive equations. And they're describing how the large scale movement of wind and water and pressure and energy are happening in the atmosphere. And those equations are great, except that those equations also, like they say, unsolved physical processes such as clouds, radiation, and precipitation are represented by semi-empirical parameterizations down in the introduction there. That's a lot of big words to say. We've got these beautiful equations, and then we have some things that those equations don't describe, and we have some other more rough equations that work decent in practice that we add on to tell you about the things that many things that are super important to us humans, like precipitation and clouds.
I put a bunch of exclamation marks next to semi-empirical because I think it's such a good way to describe it. And I think the baseline assumption is like, oh, the base case, the physics conceptual models, they're like pure. They're pure descriptions of reality. No, that's not true. There's like some semi-empirical stuff, which is such a good phrase. I mean, It's just really great to draw the comparison there because technically like machine learning is semi-empirical too. That's exactly what machine learning is.
It's just instead of humans doing the process of, well, we think it kind of works like this. So I tried this out. That worked pretty good. Maybe I'll adjust it a little bit, try it again. We have a computer doing that. So then what makes this model hybrid is that they took that same approach of having a dynamical core and some semi-empirical representations, and they kept the dynamical core coded up with the same equations. But then they replaced the semi-empirical parameterizations with neural networks. And then to make the whole thing work, though, because there's interactions back and forth between those two pieces, they actually had to code up that dynamical core in the same programming toolboxes that you use to make a neural network. And then by doing that, they're able to train it end to end. So going all the way through the physical, those parameterizations back into the dynamical core, and then the output of moving to the next time step and dynamical core running again, and the parameterizations feeding back and updating, looping back and forth. By having it all coded up in this neural network programming framework, they can actually learn those physics portions, those semi-empirical as a neural network, while still having those core primitive equations coded right in the model and actually really running in that dynamical core. What a great name.
And I have a clarifying question, but it sounds like you kind of have these two pieces, though they do talk to each other, and it's all part of the same model. But they're able to model independent things with each section. Is that correct? So they talk about how advection is handled by the dynamical core, while the machine learning parameterization models local processes with vertical columns of the atmosphere. So the sort of two halves of the model can kind of still do different things or work independently.
So the primitive equations, they tell you about the wind, they tell you about the change in pressure, they tell you about the change in energy, so like heat, and they tell you about the changes in moisture. But they don't tell you like that a cloud is going to be created right there or dissolve or get thinner. They don't tell you that water droplets are going to condense and start causing precipitation. We don't have these really beautiful, concise equations to describe those things. We've only figured them out for the subset of things that are described by those. We need something else to then, if we're going to use those equations, which are, in terms of all the equations that humans have come up with to describe the physical world, they're really up there in like good at describing what actually happens, but they just don't describe everything we care about. And so we need to then figure out the other pieces and the way they play back and forth. You can imagine like it can't just be the dynamical core running along and then later we like go figure out what clouds got made. They actually have to talk back and forth to each other because you need to know, for example, was precipitation so that because that water is now moved out, it's fallen down, it's gone down the ground, it's no longer in that part of the air, or clouds are going to be changing what's going on and the inputs to the next step of running those physical equations that's inside the dynamical core.
I want to talk about compression. What do you, Alden has heard my blabbing about this before, but if you were to maybe set that aside, Alden, what do you all think about when you think about compression?
Sorry, I had to drink some kombucha to get ready for this. So I think of many, many things getting smaller by volume, and that they take up less space.
And to pick up on that, as a result, they have to become more dense in some way. Get to some like more hardy, solid something of what's what you started with.
So a dot zip is a hardy, a groat, a file groat.
I begin my morning with 3 zip files.
Yeah.
A talk.
So I really latched onto this idea of compression. I think it was reinforced when I was hearing probably like the NVIDIA CEO talk about something about large language models. But I really like this idea of machine learning and AI really being a form of compression. I don't think that's super novel, but I think the conceptual equations that make up the dynamical core are also compression, right? Versus some sort of like derived or observed compression. And the former is what I think we do with our equations, how we arrive at those equations, and the latter is what machine learning is doing, or even these semi-empirical parameterizations. Those are also observed compression or some sort of calibration. And I like that because it puts machine learning and that process of calibration or auto-calibration on the same side. They're like kind of sitting next to each other as very similar approaches, whereas I think people have treat the machine learning or AI as like a completely new thing. So I like that. And then in the introduction, there's one section that really stuck out to me as it relates back to this concept, which is talking about the number of lines of code.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this was almost offensive. And I'll tell you why. So it says, machine learning atmospheric models also require considerably less code. For example, GraphCast has 5,417 lines versus 376,578 lines for the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration's FV3 atmospheric model. Okay, so the reason that's, there are probably multiple reasons why that I feel like is just a silly thing to say. First of all, writing these equations is not like code golf. And I can tell you right now without looking at it that that NOAA library is probably commented straight to hell.
Also, you know that Fortran code is extremely verbose.
Back to compression. This is why I thought that was just a ridiculous comparison. When you have a large language model, you can ask it to do something like sort, or like sort these alphabetically, or generate me a numbered list of this, right? Those are things we could achieve by writing an algorithm, code. But with machine learning, you are trading the code for weights. And I don't think it's a new concept for many people in the field out there, but it's kind of a new concept for me, especially as I have been experimenting more with nascent applications of some of these, like the O4 Mini, like, oh, can it do image object detection and stuff? It's hitting me that, okay, literally you could write a lot of code, or you could have you could replace that with weights. And those are almost two interchangeable things. What hit me with this is, yeah, GraphQuest has less code, but it traded that code for weights. Also, it's benefiting from however many lines of code is part of ERA5. Like, I think that's kind of brushed over a little bit. So back to compression, code is compression. An algorithm is compression. Conceptual differential equations is compression, but also weights as part of a neural network is compression. I've kind of loved that mental model because it really helps me think about these different components and how they fit together and the trade-offs of each.
To make sure that I understand what you're saying about how the equations, the physical equations, are also compressing in this conceptual way, they are kind of patterning the world. That's what I think about with most mathematical equations, is like they're taking really large concepts that we otherwise wouldn't be able to comprehend, and then either finding a pattern in them or simplifying them in some way. So it's not that they're compressing, but they help us to understand.
Well, they are literally compressing in a way. So maybe here's... So when we arrive at a law of physics, that is a concept you can now use to calculate an infinite series of that problem. I could have a book with infinite pages with a lookup table that says, if I push this object across this kind of surface, like this is how far it will move, right? I could have a table that has every solution set infinitely. I've done it a million times and I've written down the results a million times. That is, like, I would say, uncompressed. But if I can realize, like, oh, here's the equation to describe that, I'm now replacing a book of infinite pages with a one-liner.
Yeah.
One of those hot one-liners. And that is compression, right? You could throw that book away because you could rewrite that book with that equation. That is sufficient. It's not lossy, you know, version.
Yeah. That process of like finding governing principles, that is an act of compression. That's making the universe more manageable.
Yeah, and we can use that compressed artifact, the equation or the model, to get back to something we observed.
Gotcha.
And it might be lossy or lossless or whatever, but like, say I look at the sky and I see how the clouds moving and I'm like, whoa. And then I am historical genius uses that observation to be like, here's the equation for how the thing. And then now I could use that equation to re-arrive at that thing I observed. So it's compression. And what's so cool about that is, like, it totally makes sense that you would use that to model the big picture stuff and why we have the dynamical core in this hybrid sense. It's using those big picture compression artifacts, the equations, to do that part. But it's the small details that are still so hard for us as humans to compress ourselves. that we then rely on this different kind of compression through observations, either this like auto calibration or neural networks, which is just auto calibration, replacing code with weights. I guess that's my, that's how I'm going to bring it home.
Yeah. I think one reason why people are drawn to hybrid models like this, from like a human science understanding, these primitive equations are such incredibly compressed, really succinct descriptions of a huge amount of complex things that can go on. And out of all of the things that are hard for us to describe in the world, here's actually like a set of about approximately six equations that relate to each other, where we've like almost nailed it. They're really good as humanity. Like we did great.
I was wondering in my notes, are there some things for which conceptual compression is actually going to be way better? I think this is at the heart of the argument, right? Because like if you're only doing observed or machine learning driven compression, there are things at the edges, at the boundaries of what you observe in the, we don't say this enough, at the liminal, right? Like, come on. We need a liminal counter.
Oh my
I don't think
gosh.
We've said liminal yet on this show.
Da-da-da.
Come on,
this
everyone.
Gives me PTSD. I was in an MFA program, you guys.
Yeah. At the liminal edges of our observations, I think that there may be cases where if we really feel good about those physical laws, those equations, there must be a world where they're actually better than anything else we could do, another form of compression.
Oh, yeah. And I think this is actually the case in terms of a compression. Like the quantity of neural network weights you would need to represent these same equations is definitely larger than the number of bytes you'd need to write down these equations as text. Probably many orders of magnitude.
Yeah, it would resemble the infinite book, right? It like you can grow and you can grow it infinitely and search for just like a little bit more of a resolved set of weights. But the equation is kind of just it is what it is.
Well, but the catch. Before, there's always a catch.
Yeah.
Well, not always, but in this case there is actually a catch, which is that we humans have figured out these equations, but we have not figured out a way to solve them in one step or like a specific set of steps. That's the big catch. That is really why these traditional models are so computationally heavy, because we have to go to these things that called numerical methods to solve this system of equations, because it's not just one equation. It's this equation relates to this other equation that relates to this other equation. And so inputs to one of the equations is outputs from this other equation. And so they're all like self-referencing back and forth. And we humans don't have some way to just go down that set of equations then and figure it out. And so we have these solvers that usually iterate and they go through loops and loops of computation in order to get to an approximation of what the right answer is. And unfortunately, you got to do that at every single location in the atmosphere many, many times to get one time step of your model to move forward. And that's why these things are, you know, gigantic supercomputers and a lot of computation to get out. So like we've compressed their essence, but we haven't yet figured out how to like then use that efficiently. We haven't figured like the decompression effectively. To take us to a different topic, I was struck reading in the abstract, it's just an example of how quickly this world is moving. They state machine learning models trained on reanalysis data have achieved comparable or better skill than GCMs for deterministic weather forecasting. However, these models have not demonstrated improved ensemble forecasts or shown sufficient stability for long-term weather and climate simulations.
Check and check.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went and looked up the archive timestamps on when this paper first got published and then when, for example, DeepMind's Ensemble GenCast paper got published.
Which, to be fair, it's a lot of the same authors.
the Ensemble forecasting one from the GenCast paper was like a month later.
Ah. I will say, just to reverse some of my comments about us being completely uncredible, we were doing ensemble forecasts, probabilistic forecasts.
With neural networks.
With neural networks of hydrology. I don't know, what, 6 years 2019? Before this paper came out? That's weird. I looked in the references. I didn't see us referenced anywhere. I think I emailed them to let them know that there was a typo somewhere.
Yeah, nature will take it up. And then on the second point, the sufficient stability for long-term weather and climate simulations, this also has been shown to not necessarily be a downside of other models. Talk about Dale Duran's group out of University of Washington.
It's really interesting. How they did it, though, was by simplifying the neural network and constraining it by its simplicity, which allowed it to not probably get to the small details, and it forced it to remain at the big picture, and it almost forced it to be the dynamical core versus the small resolver where all the chaos lies, and so it was able to stay more stable. There's just been so much that's come out since this paper was first released, the preprint.
Yeah, and that was not that long ago.
Yeah,
that paper that we're talking about is the DL ESIM, a deep learning Earth system model for efficient simulation of observed climate.
Yeah, it's a good
one. If you hear the word parsimonious associated with AI weather forecasting, it's your go-to paper for that.
Can we talk about the word online? Because I'm trying to be offline, but this model is online.
Mm-hmm.
But not the way you think.
Anymore.
I think that actually was really interesting, that the concept of online. So basically, they say that the model is online with the dynamical core, which actually means that it's in the loop, in that kind of like solver loop. And
yeah, so people for a long time have been doing machine learning, neural network-based statistical post-processing of numerical weather prediction models. So the dynamical core is, it's just out there, it's running, it's doing its thing. And then later we get the output and we use a secondary machine learning process at the end to try to get a better prediction of all of these variables that the core can't process for us. But those aren't feeding back in and improving the next time step as that dynamical core rolls forward in time over the course of the forecast or whatever model run it's going. But like I mentioned before, you can't just have precipitation. If you just have precipitation and the model at the core of it doesn't know that that water fell down to the ground, that's going to be a problem for the accuracy as you run out into the future. What is really cool here is that they actually coded up that dynamical core in a way that it can be part of the same model and trained along with the neural network learned components of those parameterizations. And this is something that has been a goal of a lot of people's for a long time. This is something that we've been talking about to our friends and Ray Nearing for a really long time. And like, could somebody actually do this? And it's pretty impressive. They actually did it.
And they refer to that as end-to-end online training. And it's kind of, that's cool. It's a different kind of end-to-end than what we've been talking about, which is like end-to-end from observed to prediction. This is end-to-end with the loop of the solver and online training.
That brings some clarification to something I was wondering, whether or not this model would be considered end-to-end. And I think it was confusing because this is where they state themselves to be end-to-end. But thinking about the sort of framework of end-to-end that we discussed in our last episode, I was kind of thinking about the fact that there's this ensemble and then long-term version of this model that makes it more end-to-end by that previous definition that we were using.
Yeah. There are really five classes of end-to-end. maybe there's like, that was a joke, by the way. there's end-to-end, which is go from, you know, weather stations observing, using that as the training to train a forecasting or prediction model. This is like end-to-end using the differential equations in this online training way where it's like end to end there, I guess. It's not that. It uses R5. It's trained on R5.
That's the cardinal, that's the fifth cardinal direction of the center.
What, there are five?
No, the end to end, that's right there.
I think there's, I want to go back to your lines of code comment, because I think you're right. Maybe they should have said, yes, this many lines of code and also a however many gigabyte model weight file. But what this really highlights is, where is the knowledge coming from? Is this humans inputting all of their knowledge into the system in the form of equations, which is what's going on in those 376 plus thousand lines of code? Or are humans just setting up the system and saying to a general method, go and learn what you can from this data, and that in the end then gets stored? It doesn't write it down in code. It stores in a bunch of model weights, which are strengths of connections in a neural network. But
yeah, also actually kind of crazy that GraphCast is only 5,400 lines of code. Actually, now that I'm looking at that absolute number, that is bananas. Yeah. That's not much at all.
And I'm actually curious how many lines. I pulled up the repo for this last night, which is very cool. It's online. There's even the Dynamical Cores. It's in its own repo called Dinosaur. Great name.
Dinosaur.
Some might say prehistoric way of going about things.
Oh no.
So I didn't count the number of lines. But what's interesting, and so that comparison is between a full machine learning, that GraphCast, full machine learning, just 5,000 lines of code, and a fully human coded up numerical weather prediction model. I'm curious where this one falls on the total lines of code, whether it's somewhere in between or actually closer down to the lower end there.
It was compelling to me. I remember when I read that, I was like, wow, GraphCast is so elegant. That was my takeaway.
I think that the order of magnitude is actually representative, and it ties back to the like, should you take a hybrid approach to this problem as a whole? And how do you go about building systems like this?
Yeah.
And gets back to a favorite piece of writing and lesson of Marshall and I's, the bitter lesson. Here is a system where somebody tried to put some of what we know inside the system, and then also have it learn some other parts of it. And it gets some results that are really cool and exciting in the short term. And the lesson from the bitter lesson is, in the long term, you might be better off just going with an approach that really leverages learning from data, because those methods get better and better as computers get faster and faster. And you can collect
more and more data to learn.
Yeah, exactly. And we've got no signs of maxing out our data about the Earth right now.
Although, sorry. Richard Sutton is the author of The Bitter Lesson. I used to think he was cool. Then I heard a podcast with him where he likes Bitcoin. But his ideas are great. Okay, but hear me out. He's all about reinforcement learning. And part of that whole class of problem is that if reinforcement learning is cool, it's where you basically describe an environment, you give an agent a set of actions it could take, a reward mechanism or reward function, and then just let it like act forever. This is going to be embarrassing, but it's the best I can come up with for my Dragon Ball Z fans out there. I haven't watched it since I was 13, but there's a concept called the hyperbolic time chamber, where these two characters go in and they like train for like infinity years, and they come out and they're like, we just trained for infinity years, but like only 1 year passed for you or something. That's basically what these reinforcement learning agents get to do, right? They get to become experts for a billion years of like trying and failing and refining and trying and failing. I think so. Richard Sutton's thing in The Bitter Lesson is like, if you can scale the search function, that's basically searching for the optimal policy for how to act in this environment with this reward mechanism. If we can create problems where search can scale with compute, you could just let it run longer and it will get better. That is one way to create a super powerful thing. So like that's how they beat the best Go player, right? You can come up with these incredible optimal strategies by this method. I do wonder if that is a heavily underutilized, like if you think about it, I wonder if there's something, I actually think Sutton is working on something like this, a model architecture that combines some of the best of search with gradient set descent. Anyway, I need to look that up. And I don't know if I ever shared it with you, Alden, but the hardest part in reinforcement learning is always like describing the environment. That is the hard part. If there were, this is another phrase that we are completely underutilizing on this podcast. If we were able to create a, say, digital twin. Oh, Marta and Alden just got knocked out. They're incapacitated. If we were able to create a digital twin of the Earth, I'll just stop there.
Yeah. Doppelganger lit Rex coming next.
I'm going to go out and say, I think the best way to create a digital twin, oh my God, I can't believe. Digital twin, sidebar, digital twin is the phrase that comes up in like so much marketing stuff in our world that it's just hard to say it with a straight face at this point.
Yeah.
If I think the best way to create this simulation world of our natural Earth environment is by learning it from data. And I think that we may, in the end, come to the realization that we didn't need to spend all this time putting our precious equations into these models, and that they can figure it out in their own way. And the equations that they learn won't look like the ones that we know, but
that's right.
You can solve them. You can instantly get the answer out of them. You don't need an iterative approach generally, and they scale with compute and data, which are forces that are going to be pretty strong tailwinds pushing you forward these days in this world.
I thought that the equations, like those core equations, were related to like the core concepts of fluid dynamics.
They are.
But so we're going to have new ones?
We're having neural networks, which are learning approximations of them and all of the other things that they don't represent, and in the process, a lot more efficient to actually evaluate and get an answer out of. And in the end, my hunch is that's going to be the maybe unsatisfying way, ultimately, that this plays out. But for another day, I've got some thoughts on the unsatisfying portion of things and like what's our human role still in this whole process? Because there is one. Very important one.
Cliffhanger. Maybe just to close out the paper, I thought that I liked the section on the different ways they measured their performance. They're using root mean squared error. They're using root mean squared bias, continuous rank probability score, skill spread ratio. I dug into the spread skill ratio. I dug into that a bit. I thought that was cool. I think I just like the way they presented it. And if you're into that sort of thing, I'm getting a little tired of reading the accuracy benchmarks of all these papers because they're all pretty similar. But I actually thought I liked the way they presented the rationale behind the different equations and presented it. There was one last topic that in the water budget section, because this is where they're talking about like how they can basically do things like ensure that certain laws of conservation are upheld, right? But this was something, Alden, that we found. Do you remember the paper Gray wrote that was like about how that actually makes machine learning worse because of all the uncertainty in the observations and inputs? This is where like the synthesis of physical laws and machine learning, neural networks, they may not be compatible because one is trying to smooth over the chaos and the uncertainty, and the other is trying to treat it as absolute And those two things don't always go hand in hand. Can you just like quickly summarize Gray's paper? Because I thought that was really interesting when he put that out.
Yeah. So you can add in things to even your neural network models, which say certain things have to be held true within this model. So you would think within hydrology that at least like water that goes in has to equal water that goes out over some long period of time. It's got that water didn't go disappear. It's somewhere. And these are like should be the most basic things. But when you constrain with really hard constraints that in water in equals water out, and or you know you include mass and energy, and these are like the core physical things that should be true. The reality is like we don't actually have complete observations of water and energy in and out anywhere. And so, like Marshall was saying, if you can actually learn to handle the imperfectness of your observations in a practical setting, that's actually pretty darn useful. And if you apply these hard physical constraints, you, in practice, often end up actually giving up some performance because out in the real world, we just don't have perfect observations of pretty much anything.
So you almost have to have that in mind that they may not be compatible in this really important way.
Yeah. I didn't get quite deep enough into this when reading this paper, but I believe that neural network can actually be playing that role in this. It's able to go nudge and adjust the states in the atmosphere that go into the next time steps of the dynamical core. And because of that, it can actually do a little bit of learning to account for precipitation and also maybe the learning to account for our observations aren't perfect too.
Yeah. Jumping to the conclusion or the discussion section on that note, I love this. The neural GCM approach is compatible with incorporating either more physics or more machine learning as required for operational weather forecasts and climate simulations. Any other closing thoughts?
We didn't talk about resolution. So this model can operate at a lower resolution while still being pretty accurate, I think is maybe the like headline. I think this group is always excited to see you can have an accurate output without a ton of computer power behind it.
Mm-hmm. They even have a table at the end that shows the resource usage. And we're talking like 250 megabytes to 4 gigabytes of RAM. GPU RAM. It's nothing. Nothing. So it, totally in that vein, this is if someone were to want to operationalize this model, it seems very parsimonious.
Exactly. Right. So I think what I'm curious about, maybe that relationship between resolution and interpretability. It seems like you do lose a little bit of interpretability if something is run at a lower resolution. Feel free to push back on that. But I think it's sort of interesting that it seems like what I'm noticing in the trend of the conversations that we've had so far is that a more trustworthy forecast seems to be about accuracy rather than interpretability. That indicates this kind of shift in that classical definition of science that I brought up in the last episode. And it feels like a pretty seismic shift to me. We're moving toward this definition of science as less about understanding the world, interpreting the world, and more about accurately forecasting the future. And I think to me,
I think I see what you mean. I'm sure there's like elegant descriptions of fluid dynamics out there that, you know, warm the hearts of fluid dynamicists everywhere. But I think as soon as you move to the applied world, what we're seeing is like, yeah, you got to pair those with these semi-empirical bits that totally remove the interpretability.
Yeah.
If you want it to be accurate. And so as soon as you cross that boundary from like the pure theory to applied and you're trying to get something out of it that's usable, then I think it's kind of the same. Like, I don't think we're moving away from interpretability necessarily. And I think we actually, with all of this energy focused at the space, I think we're going to see, like Alden has said in the past, like an increase of interpretability just because we're going to build better tools around interpreting the forecast.
Or perhaps maybe we even, in a really roundabout way, end up training models that can forecast things better than we could describe them, and then somehow get those models to distill themselves down into something that is really compressed and concise that we humans can start to now understand. And maybe from that, we somehow fill out a set of additional equations that cover all of the phenomena in the atmosphere that we really care about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that this isn't how the models work right now, but I could see this is sort of what Sam Altman and some of those other dweebs are like trying to pitch of like science acceleration. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I could see a world where a model is like, good job, humans. You really tried really hard on the whole fluid dynamics thing, but here's the true solution, you know, and like hands us an equation. We're not trying to do that right now because I think it's like, well, is that through language? Is it through like, how do you train something to think science? What is the language of science? I guess it's sort of written word, sort of math. I don't really know. We're trying to apply to the problem, which is neural networks, weights, predicting for the domain. But I could see a world where like maybe you could reverse out of the weights somehow, like some understanding of the science and some equation that describes the universe.
Well, I think what, like, you know, if those new equations come out of machine learning and like this technology and this sort of like technological moment, I think I just want to know what those are. And I don't necessarily have to deeply understand them. It would be cool if someone did, but I don't view that's my role in all of this. I would love to know what those are. And just that, I think that bit of knowing does feel important to me from this kind of a theoretical. Like
certified organic. It's like certified that at least one human understands what's going on in here.
Well.
For machine learning models out there, it's like certified that one human has taken at least their best go at understanding what's in here.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would just also be like so cool to know what those things are, the new hypothetical equations that come to us via machine learning. And I think the other thing, my final thought on this, and why I think this like knowing is important, when I say knowing, I also mean the venturing toward knowing. There's a philosopher. 20th century, turn of the 20th century German philosopher, Max Weber, who described that moment in time, the turn of the 20th century, as the biggest injury to humanity was this loss of enchantment. And he was very much reacting to the philosophical and scientific rationality that was defining the last few hundred years. And I think I believe that. And I think that all I want us to do is just keep on venturing toward that knowing, even if, you know, the bitter lesson is that we will never be as good at the computers as operating these things. Mm. But yeah, like I think there's just a lot to be curious about what the models are doing.
I agree with that. And this is maybe back to like science fiction. The piece that is so compelling to me is like we always think that we're doing all right, you know, we're smart enough and we've gotten far enough, but like jump back far enough in our past and you look at the state of mathematics and you're like, wow, we've discovered a lot of pretty basic things in that time period. And so the exciting piece to me is sort of this, like, what if there's a whole different branch of mathematics we haven't discovered? And differentiable equations is like our best bet at approximating these things, just because we don't have this like recursive brand of math that we like can't even conceive of ourselves. there may be things outside of our ability. I mean, actually, computers themselves, it's a good proxy. There are many things outside of our ability that we've had in the past couple decades had to use computers to achieve scientifically, mathematically. Yeah. And I think I would like to think of these models as just extensions of the computer, you know, extensions of that theme of like our ability to compute things.
Well, I think even the suggestion that there might be this yet discovered math out there.
Oh, there is. There definitely
right.
is.
Right. I mean, that's what I hope for us as a species, that we continue to wonder that those things are out there. And the models are ushering in a level of intelligence that is unprecedented, and they might get us closer to seeing the edge of that yet to be discovered mathematical equation.